You don't have to go very far to see that there's a lot of controversy and violence in our society at this moment, and it seems like things are kind of spiraling out of control. Even this morning, as I turned on the news, watching local news, that there were reports of just so far this weekend, the weekend's not even over yet, of 7 murders in Baltimore City. Murder rate is up across the United States in our major cities. And it's so disheartening. We can turn on our TV, look at our computers, our tablets, our smartphones, and it just seems like mayhem is everywhere. And usually what happens is we wake up and we hear the news overnight of what has happened, because quite frankly, most violent crimes happen in the cover of darkness. The FBI puts together statistics every year, and they're pretty much consistent about this. For instance, it says that 87% of all DUIs and DWIs happen at night. Murders, 65%. Sexual assault, 59%. Robbery, 56%. Aggravated assault, 54%. And auto theft, 51%. All of these things take place at night. Now, it isn't surprising, because when it's dark, it's easier to get away with things. It's harder to make out a person. It's harder to identify them. People tend to be asleep. And usually what I would tell my kids when they were teenagers, you know, when it gets about midnight, you need to come home, because nothing good happens after midnight. That was our philosophy. And so it's important for us to understand that, that it affects us. When I was thinking about crime and things that have happened over my, from the times that I could actually count up, my house, something either from my yard or in my house, we've been robbed at least 7 times, over the decades, all at night. And one time the person actually came in during the night and robbed us in the house where we were sleeping upstairs, which that's a whole different kind of criminal who was willing to come in and take a chance of having a confrontation with you. There have been at least 3 times of vandalism on property that I've had, and that has always happened in the dark of night. People just seem to be their worst at night. So today, when we pick up in our study in Mark chapter 14, starting with verse 43, we are literally entering the darkest part of the Gospel of Mark, and it starts at night. It begins with Jesus' arrest while he was with his disciples in the Garden of Gethsemane. He had just spent a few hours in prayer there. His disciples, unfortunately, were spending a few hours napping there. And having come back a third time, he had to tell them, he says, "Are you still sleeping and taking rest? It's enough. The hour has come. The Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise up. Let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand." And we pick up with Mark verse 43 of chapter 14. It says this, "And immediately, while he was still speaking, Judas came up." Judas came, one of the 12. "And with him a crowd with swords and clubs, and the chief priest, and from the chief priest and the scribes and the elders." Clubs, swords. John's gospel tells us that they also had a few torches and a few lanterns with them. You might even get the image of an old black and white Frankenstein movie of the peasants storming the castle with their torches and pitchforks and things. And it could be comical, except for it wasn't, because it wasn't fiction. It was reality. But this angry mob shows up, and along with people in general, but the temple guards and Roman soldiers kind of made up the core. And they were coming up to as if Jesus was some terrorist bent on revolutionary upheaval. And when Mark refers to the crowd, he uses the word crowd while the other Gospels talk about the soldiers or the guard. He talks about a crowd because apparently there's probably more that were a part of it. But it's also strategic because at this moment in the Gospel Mark, there it's kind of a hinge. Things are happening. Up until this point, when Mark would talk about a crowd, the crowd was basically positive towards Jesus. When Jesus was out teaching and healing, the crowd was excited. But this was an angry crowd. This was a rabble who came out. And from this moment on, the crowds in the Gospel of Mark were always hostile to Jesus. So we kind of see that there's a change of public opinion. The religious leaders of the time were so angry at Jesus, working their best to discredit him, to try to turn popular opinion against him. Of course, it tells us that they were being led by Judas. And Mark makes sure that we understand that the betrayer came from one of the 12. And why does he do that? Because it's indicating the shock of it, especially when one considers Judas's place within the disciples. They're the ones that trusted him the most to let him have the money back so that he would take care of the finances of the group. They were the ones that admired him enough to give him the second seat of privilege right next to Jesus at the Lord's Supper, at the Passover meal. So Judas would have been considered not only a part of the 12, but maybe the one who would actually take over if something were to happen to Jesus. There was an admiration for him. And so this indicates this the utmost shock of it would be of it being Jesus. It also might be a reminder that it is the Judas that was one of the 12 disciples, because Judas was a very popular name at this time. Not as popular today, if you have noticed that. But it used to be super popular. Actually, that one of the half-brothers of Jesus, his name was Judas. It's a very, very popular name. So probably all the people who were named Judas and the scriptures being read were like, oh. Glad that he's pointing out which one it is. And in verse 44. Now the betrayer had given them a sign, saying, "The one I will kiss is the man. Seize him and lead him away under guard." And when he came, he went up to him at once and said, "Rabbi." And he kissed him. And they laid hands on him and seized him. You know, there's a phrase called Judas's kiss, or the kiss of Judas. You don't really hear it so much anymore. Basically, it meant an act of appearing to be an act of friendship, which in fact was harmful to the recipient. You know, it was about being betrayed. And it comes from this narrative. And Judas comes up to him, refers to him as a teacher, Rabbi, which is a title of respect. So he's acting like there's nothing wrong. And even the disciples, for the most part, would have just seen this as natural. Now, he's not probably leading the band of rabble with him. They're probably standing off at the distance, waiting to see who he's going to kiss. And so when he goes and he kisses him, back in that time and place, when you would greet a rabbi, it was customary to kiss them, usually on the hand to show deference, or on the cheek if you believe that you were equal to the person. Now, I'm going to probably guess that Judas kissed him on the cheek because he probably saw himself, if not equal to Jesus, maybe even superior to Jesus. And the word that Mark uses for kiss is actually one of a prolonged affection. So it was probably a prolonged kiss because he wanted to make sure the soldiers and the temple guard knew exactly who to arrest. Now we have to remember, this is at night. And the temple guard and the Roman soldiers may not really know who Jesus is. They might have seen him at afar. They've certainly have heard of him, but they might not have recognized him. And you know, in that place, guy in a robe, long beard, long hair, well, that kind of fits a lot of people, right? So they need to make sure that they get the right person. And also, you think about this, this is at night. We don't know that the disciples had any torches or any lanterns. That's not said. The torches and the lanterns that the soldiers were using would not give that much light out. If you ever gone camping and used an old lantern or just even a flashlight going through the path, you know, at night, you know, through the woods, very dark, even with the light, you have to be careful what you're doing. Or if you're around a bonfire with a group of people, those that are sitting really close to it, you can kind of see who they are. But you get further out a little bit, it's very dark. So this is a opportunity for a lot of mayhem to break out. So they needed to make sure that they knew exactly who they were going to arrest. Now notice also that Judas gives them instructions. He says, "The one that I kiss is the man. Seize him and lead him away under guard." So basically what he's telling the soldiers and the temple guard, you get him under control, you arrest him, and you put him in restraint. So he is treating him as if he is this rebellious terrorist. And it makes you wonder, did he not pay attention at all during the whole 3 years that he was with Jesus? Did he not listen to his teachings? Did he not see in his demeanor that he would not be, that he was not this? Of course, he just decided that he was going to demonstrate his authority over Jesus. He was going to lead this mob, take over from Jesus, or at least force Jesus' hand to set up the kingdom. Whatever Judas was motivated by, it wasn't just money, it was more than that. But Jesus' submission to what was going on demonstrated just how foolish it was to have such human intrigue. And you notice, there is no response from Jesus regarding Judas in Mark's account. And Judas disappears after this from the narrative. And then the account goes on in verse 47. "But one of those who stood by drew his sword and struck the servant of the high priest and cut off his ear." That's all that they talked, that's all that was mentioned in the Gospel of Mark about this particular incident. The other Gospels kind of flesh it out a little bit for us. We know that the servant's name is Malchus, and it was Peter who cut off the ear. Surprise, surprise, impetuous Peter. But to give Peter a little bit of a break, there is probably more sword play than this that's going on. Just think about that. The disciples are waking up from their slumber. Judas shows up, and all of a sudden an angry mob shows up. The disciples had a few swords with them. There were probably some sword play that's taking place. And as things are kind of breaking down, the sword hits, the blade of the sword hits the priest's servant, and the ear comes off. And we know that Jesus rebukes the people at that time about his disciples, and he restores the ear back onto Malchus. But Jesus doesn't rebuke the disciples here, but he does confront the mob. And Jesus said to them in verse 48, "Have you come out against a robber with swords and clubs to capture me? Day after day, I was with you in the temple teaching, and you did not seize me. But let the scriptures be fulfilled." So Jesus condemned the violent nature of the mob who came out to arrest him. Now, it says robber in this translation, but it actually has a better usage, would be kind of one who's leading a rebellion. Terrorist might be a little bit strong, but that would be closer to the meaning of this. It's somebody who is corrupt, who would be considered kind of a thief, but actually seeing an opportunity to raise a ruckus and to better his own pockets. So it's more of a revolutionary. So Jesus went on. He says, you know, am I this revolutionary that you're coming? I've been here for a week, guys. I've been teaching publicly. Most everything I've been saying has been public. I've been in the temple every single day. And there is nothing secretive about what I was doing and nothing seditious about my teachings. But the religious leaders just could not stand it. The religious leaders just, they heard his teaching. They saw his crowds growing in admiration for him. He challenged their authority. They just were seething that he was coming in on their turf and having better numbers than they were. And so they wanted to do something about that. They had a plan to arrest him and then to dispose of him. And Jesus, in this passage, he not only kind of rebukes them for this, but he also at the end here, he says, but let the scriptures be fulfilled. So while these religious leaders hatched their plan to arrest him and to kill him, what was actually happening is they were helping along God's purpose of accomplishing the redemption of mankind. And I think sometimes that's something that we have to remember, is that, well, there's all sorts of chaos that might be going around us, and it seems like mayhem, and maybe things are all at a loss. God is working out his plan. So he makes a statement of faith. And the disciples, in verse 50, they all left him and fled. These are the same disciples who, a few hours earlier, had said, we will stand with you no matter what. No matter what happens, we will go, we will die with you. We can suffer whatever you're going to suffer. So when they had this opportunity to demonstrate their words, they failed. Talk is cheap. They had opportunity to put their money where their mouth was, and it didn't happen. Now, I think we can give them a little bit of sympathy and empathy, because let's just be honest, we don't know what we would do in that situation either. We would all like to hope that we would stand firm and be able to suffer the same things that Jesus would suffer. But we do not know that until that moment. So we will give them a little bit of grace. And then in verse 51 and 52, a little odd insertion happens. Not in any other gospel, but in the Gospel of Mark, there's this little incident that is mentioned. And a young man followed him with nothing but a linen cloth about his body, and they seized him. But he left the linen cloth and ran away naked. Now, seems like a little bit of an odd statement, right? Except for it kind of fleshes out a little bit more of the narrative. Kind of gives it a little bit, this, you know, a bigger picture of what's happening. Now, some people have tried to make this some sort of symbol. Like Jesus was about to be stripped naked and crucified, and then his body would be wrapped in linen cloth to be buried. I just never go for that kind of stuff. There's a thing called Cooper's Golden Rule. When you come to a passage of Scripture, it says, if the plain sense makes common sense, seek no other sense. So it doesn't really fit that this is a type of Christ. It seems like there was some young guy there who actually kind of got caught up in the crowd and had to flee for his life. And there's speculation, and I kind of lean this way, and it is just speculation, but I think we can make a case for it, that it is probably Mark. Now, he wasn't one of the 12. However, there's a good chance this is him, because he's writing it, and no other gospel carries it. So maybe the other disciples were even unaware that this happened to him. It would be kind of, if we were to talk about it in modern terms, and even our modern terms, I'm talking about in the last 50, 60 years, I would call this the Alfred Hitchcock cameo. You know, in Alfred Hitchcock movies, not in all of them, but most of them, there's a cameo. He makes a cameo in all of his movies. In the Renaissance time, famous painters would paint their faces in the crowd of people in their paintings. That's a way that they would put their signature in. So we're thinking that maybe Mark is putting his signature into the gospel. Now, why do I think it might be Mark? Well, a couple reasons. First, his mother was a wealthy woman, very prominent in the early church. And having a linen garment actually would be a sign of wealth. She also had a large home that the church in Jerusalem met in after the death of Jesus. In Acts 12, verse 11 and 12, it won't appear on the screen though. Now, I am sure that the Lord has sent his angel and rescued me. And this is Peter talking about his deliverance from prison. So he's sure that the angel has delivered him and rescued him from the hand of Herod, from all the Jewish people, and from that what the Jewish people were expecting. When he realized this, he went to the house of Mary, the mother of John, whose other name was Mark, where many were gathered together and were praying. Early on in the early church, Mary's house had become associated with the Passover meal of Christ and the Last Supper. So here, Mark would have been very young. He'd been a kid, maybe 10, 11, 12 years old. Following a group of the people who were in his house, Jesus would have been considered a celebrity to them. And he's probably just hanging out like kids do. And there is a truthfulness about this encounter, because you think about this, if you've ever dealt with small children and you're trying to get their attention, or they're in harm, or you're trying to grab a hold of them and you grab their shirt, they can squirm out of that really fast. So here he is, all the other people have left. He's probably in shock, just kind of standing there. One of the mob says, well, he's part of them, let's grab him. They grab his linen, he probably squirms out and off he goes, naked. No matter why it's there or who this is, ultimately what we recognize is it helps us see the terror of the moment, the absolute fear that had come over those who were with Jesus Christ. And we can understand that terror as they sought to get away. So what do we do with this passage? What do we learn about this passage? And I think really what we see in this passage is an opportunity. How do we respond when things seem to become really crazy? When the world turns upside down, where there seems to be mayhem afoot everywhere we turn? How are we going to respond as Christ followers who have placed our faith in Jesus Christ? So we have to ask ourselves, do we initially fight back with the same tactics of the world? The disciples did that, and that was going to be of no effort. Here the disciples drew their swords, they kind of did a little sword play, somebody gets their ear cut off, and Jesus said enough is enough of that. Now it's easy for us to think that we should respond as the world responds. We want to have those quick responses. We might even think of Untouchables, where it talks about if they bring a knife, we bring a gun. Well, that's Hollywood. That might be Chicago, but that's not the Bible. So when somebody is saying something or doing something or trying to discredit somebody, we might feel like we should respond in kind, but that's not the tactics that we're supposed to take. When somebody vilifies somebody or discredits them or dehumanizes them, we might want to respond with those same accusations back. And that just doesn't go anywhere. We're already seeing that does not go anywhere in our society now. We are more divided than ever. Or do we disappear in the darkness out of fear? Because let's just face it, if you say something that's maybe just not taken right, or maybe it is taken right, people can lose your job. You can lose a job. People can be shamed enough where their whole life has come on hold. It is amazing at the speed to which people will seek to destroy somebody's life. I was reading this morning, and I know it happened a while back, but I was reading this morning about Connor Daly. He's a NASCAR driver. And when he was his first, his father's from Ireland, and his father used a racial expletive one time back in 1980 on the radio. And when that came out, even though Connor wasn't born, everybody pulled their sponsorship from him. And they forced him to apologize for his dad. And he was like, I didn't use it. I don't approve of that. And my dad, when he said it, it was a term that they use in Ireland all the time. He realized he shouldn't say it in America, never said it again. But there was unforgiveness there. And it's easy for us to kind of step back. But let me just share with you, as I was reading in the Christian Post this week, that attacks on Christians, and especially physical attacks on church property, is really rising in the United States, and it's not being reported. Arson, vandalism, people seeking to harm parishioners, and no media is carrying that. This has been going on for a couple years in France, where churches have been set on fire, and another cathedral was set on fire on purpose yesterday. So we're going to recognize that for the traditional Christian beliefs that we have, people are going to try to silence us, they are going to try to belittle us, because they think they know what we believe. They think they know our attitudes. They think they know our hearts. But the reality is, they do not. So do we shrink back in fear, or do we actually step forward and speak into the fray? Well, Christ calls us to stand for faith as he did. He wasn't violent. He wasn't seditious. When they came as an angry mob, he did not respond in kind, but actually condemned his disciples for doing so. He didn't use their same demeaning and violent tactics. And we have to recognize that there are times that we're going to want to feel to do that. Especially when you see the things that you hold dear, that you believe in, that are sacred to you, that are being trashed and being discarded. And you may feel like the current confusion of life, that there seems like nothing is right any longer. That the world is turning upside down, and everything that you value, everything that you hold dear, and that it is just is going out the window. But what we need to do is be just like Christ and trust God, that he is working out his purpose no matter what we see on this TV and computer screens. Our response, quite simply, is that of quiet dignity of faith, resting in our saving relationship with Jesus Christ. So that just means if we confess Jesus as our Lord, well, we should live like that. We should model how he treated people. If we recognize him as our Savior, the one who forgives us, well, maybe we can be forgiving too. Maybe we can extend mercy to those who really don't know what they are doing. So when you have that desire to fight back, remember, we're not to take, we're my side, it shouldn't be about my side versus their side. Usually that's our political sides. Only thing we want to know is, am I on God's side? And we should also recognize that there are going to be times on some minor issues in life that we are going to disagree with people who are on God's side too. But we need to respond always with that quiet dignity of faith.